Before we get started, I'd like to say thank you to Haemonetics for their generous and unrestricted grant for the Educational Resources Committee and TraumaCast. My name is Tatiana Cardenas. I am an acute care surgeon at Dell Medical School at the University of Texas in Austin.
Hi, it's great to be here. I'm Rochelle Dicker. I'm a professor of surgery at UCLA and trauma medical director here and co-director of the Program for the Advancement of Surgical Equity and part of the Committee on Trauma.
Hi, thanks for the invitation. I'm Leah Tatabri. I am an associate professor of surgery at Northwestern and also a trauma surgeon.
Thank you all so much for being here. I really appreciate you taking the time. This is a really interesting topic for me personally. We're going to get into some discussion about trauma-informed care and maybe take away some practical implementation tactics of that for our audience. So, first question, right out of the gate, what is trauma-informed care?
So I would say trauma-informed care, the way that I think of it is making sure that we're treating our patients within the context that they bring to the hospital. It's not just a physical injury, or it doesn't even have to be a trauma patient, just a physical ailment. They come in with life experiences and prior emotional, psychological, physical wounds that we need to acknowledge and make sure that we are treating them in an empathetic and comprehensive way.
I love that, Dr. Tatabe, because sometimes people characterize trauma-informed care as just good doctoring, and it is if you do it right, but that's the end result. There's so much to understanding trauma-informed care that is just exactly what Dr. Tatabe said, and that's understanding that trauma is not just physical injury, and understanding that people can bring toxic stress and adverse childhood experiences with them to the trauma bay, along with their physical injury. And appreciation of that for us allows us that empathetic lens that she talked about.
Can we talk a little bit about the history of the development of a trauma-informed approach to healthcare? I think that would be, you know, hugely helpful because this has been around for quite some time.
Yes. Really, if you look back in the history, the organization, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, really has a nice overview of trauma-informed care. And those words are really very North American. So you'll hear it called different things in different countries, different continents. But for us, it started back in 2019, us being the trauma community, when the first medical summit was held and there was an appreciation that we needed to address the social determinants of health or root causes for violent injury. And this group that Dr. Tatabe and I are on called Improving the Social Determinants to Attenuate Violence, or ISAVE, came out with four initiatives back in 2019. And one of those initiatives was trauma-informed care, the development of a curriculum through the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma in trauma-informed care. And that's what we have accomplished over the course of the last few years.
Awesome. You brought up ISAVE. This was going to be a question that I had a little bit later on, but I love that you brought it up. With those four tactics and implementing trauma-informed care, how do we start to do that from an individual standpoint, an institutional standpoint, and then also maybe even a community standpoint?
Well, I can tell you, I can start off, and Dr. Tatabe, please jump in. What's really interesting is that as we started to talk about this curriculum that is being piloted in 19 trauma centers across the country right now, hopefully we'll finish by the end of September so that it can be ready to include what we've learned into, yes, ATLS in the next edition. So trauma-informed care will be in the next edition. I'm getting ahead of myself, though. Yeah, it's very exciting.
That's amazing.
But on an individual level, as I was starting to talk it up and chat with my residents here at UCLA, It's so interesting how the culture change started to happen, and conversations with ED colleagues, and all of a sudden that individual part that you said started to spread. And then on an institutional level, part of the trauma-informed care curriculum that's in 19 trauma centers now at different stages, talks about how to systematically make your trauma center trauma-informed. And then in a broader sense, just what I said as I jumped ahead, because I'm so excited about it, but it's going to be in all of our vernacular, really, because it is codified. It's going to be part of the 11th edition of ATLS.
That's fantastic. Can you take us through the crawl, walk, run version of potentially implementing this into a system? I know that there's a curriculum, which I want to ask you guys a few more details about the curriculum, but how can I really implement this at any institution in a practical way?
You know, that's a great question. I think a lot of it is, right now we're kind of just working on disseminating the idea. And I feel like a lot of people, kind of as Dr. Digger said, kind of already do this, right? As part of our good doctoring, we understand it kind of inherently, but we haven't named it. We haven't been very intentional about it. And so I've been absolutely thrilled having different institutions across the country invite leaders in this and really those who are kind of at the forefront come and just talk about it. And I think that's the easiest way, just to kind of pay attention to the words that we're using, pay attention to things, you know, if we're saying, oh, he was just minding his business, taking his grandma to church, all of those little things that we kind of say, but realizing the true implications behind it. Right. And so just having an intentionality about it, you don't really need anything else than that. That's a nice, easy crawl way to go, as you put it. And I think just improving the conversations about it, inviting speakers to come and actually talk to it, getting stakeholders involved. I think it's phenomenal when we're able to bring patients in and actually ask them what their experiences were. I know we had a symposium a couple years ago, and we asked patients that were, you know, our urban interpersonal violent patients, injured patients that came through, what was one thing that they wish was different during their hospital stay? And unanimously, they said, I just want to be treated like a person, not as a wound, as a base six with a stab or whatever it was, that there's a human behind the injury and having that acknowledged. And that is just such a simple way to have it incorporated into your practice immediately. It's just that intentionality of it. I think the run part is sort of the gold standard that ISAVE is putting out and with this curriculum. And there, say there are some institutions even before the ISAVE curriculum came out that were requiring every single employee of the hospital to get trained in trauma-informed care. So from environmental services to radiology techs to, you know, clearly the surgeon, the ER and nurses and everybody else, but the greeters, even at the door, you know, people at the information desk, when people are coming in and they're upset or they are questioning things or what do we need? Really making sure that everybody who could possibly have a point of contact with our patients is aware that this is the tactic that we should be taking.
I really love the comment that you made about the intentionality. Like, you know, we practice to make people better and to help people in their time of need. It really resonates with me that, you know, you're saying that there's got to be this an intentional conversation had amongst providers, amongst staff, amongst our nursing colleagues. I mean, RT. I mean, I think that's absolutely fantastic. Where can we go to get said curriculum or to see said curriculum that we've been talking about that you guys have mentioned?
The 19 trauma centers right now that have signed up to be part of this pilot, it's quite a bit of work that goes into it. It's not just an hour PowerPoint presentation, but it's also spending a little bit of time with a healthcare provider, understanding that a lot of our coping mechanisms are pretty dysfunctional as a result of our own secondary or vicarious trauma. So it's good to acknowledge that and name it and understand what the resources are. There's also time that's spent with a lived experience expert that's local, because the community is going to experience structural racism, toxic stress in a different way in Memphis than they are in Los Angeles. So it's good to have a local understanding of it. So all of that means that there's a lot to it. If you wanted to sign up for the pilot right now, it would be a heavy lift to get it done by the end of September. But at the end of that, we're going to analyze what we've learned from the experience and make it available for all. So the ATLS version is going to be a very distilled down version, but the book will have a link to this broader curriculum so that it'll be widely available on the COT website. We have had a series of Train the Trainers courses, and that's still going to be necessary to get certified if you are running a course, just like you would with ATLS. I have a feeling that version 2.0 is going to be a little bit shorter than the way we've planned it, just for feasibility purposes. That's what we're hearing right now from the sites. But it will be widely available, hopefully by 2024.
With regards to teaching our medical students and our residents, is this something that in your institutions, it's implemented in their didactic curriculum? Is this something that happens on rounds? Is this something that in terms of making them aware of vicarious trauma, there's a lot of stress that providers will also face. We have to understand our limits. We have to understand that this exists. And so how do we start to address this, inform our learners so that they can kind of take this and incorporate in their future practices?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the way that we're incorporating it into our medical education is a combination of a didactic, just to be purposeful about it, be informed about it, but then also encouraging people to speak up, to notice when it's done well, notice when it's done not well, help kind of breed good behaviors. I believe with a conference we were just at, people were talking about as well that it's once you start talking about it, it's amazing how many times people will point it out and call it out and say, hey, you know what, this was an opportunity that we could have been better for our patients, acknowledging it. From anything as simple as, you know, when you first hit the trauma bay and you're cutting clothes off, understanding the vulnerability around it and saying, just either if it's necessary, just somebody saying, hey, we've got to do this, you know, we got, you know, having a blanket right there, somebody at the head of the bed explaining what's going on and why, you know, why we need to do it, not just that we're going to do it. This is something that, you know, we've got three female trauma surgeons on here, right? Cutting a bra off, that's a big financial thing, right? So, you know, you have these issues that may be the one thing that they have, or these may be the only set of clothes that they have. And having just that incorporated and discussed, I think is a really good way to get it involved. I think we do point out from a vicarious trauma standpoint that, you know, when we debrief about about how it affected us, it's important to say, okay, now put yourself in the patient's shoes. What does that actually look like? And the efforts that I've done of actually having kind of a VR simulation of a trauma from the patient's perspective and realizing how violating an initial resuscitation can be from a situation. So I think that's a really good way to just sort of start the conversation and then actively keep reinforcing the good skills during these the educational moments.
And I'll just really quickly add that what Dr. Tatebe is describing actually reduces our secondary and vicarious trauma. There's data to support that. Feels pretty darn good. And I can tell you that our residents, it's just, they feel empowered now. I've heard our residents with utmost professionalism go up to somebody else in the trauma, but hey, you know, that's not okay to say that, you know, or to a security guard, can you like take the handcuffs off? Like, that's not okay, you know? So things like that, it starts to feel really good and very empowering to act on behalf of the patient in that way. So it helps the providers as well.
Within this curriculum, I know that it's going to be widely available in 2024, but we know about it now. And is there, other than, you know, understanding resources for vicarious trauma that providers experience, is there any other training that goes into that part of addressing trauma-informed care from a provider standpoint?
I think there are a number of resources, I mean, including this trauma cast will be one of them coming out, right? And so I think there are a number of experts out there certainly available to give lectures. And I think that's a great way just to sort of start the conversation. Even just reading some of the work that's been previously mentioned, SAMHSA's work on trauma-informed care, the ISAVE article that came out in JACS, I think it was last year, 2 years ago. That's a wonderful resource and some great papers out there. So I think there's a number of places to kind of look for it in the meantime.
For providers who take care of, you know, the traumatically injured pediatric patient, whatever age they are, do the approaches change with regard to trauma-informed care? What's the difference between, you know, kids and adults? What additional resources do we need to have in place, et cetera?
I feel like this is almost a little more naturally done in a pediatric environment. We're used to being very aware that if a child comes in who's injured, they're going to be scared. They're going to be looking at things. They'll have a sense of wanting, okay, where's the parent or the guardian, whoever they need as their support system. We have it even from people who have special needs that come in. We have an autistic child that comes in, having a bunch of people around them all at once is probably not the best way to take care of them, right? So I think we think about it a little bit more carefully whenever there's a child or somebody with special needs involved. But I think what we're seeing really is that this is a universal thing that we need to be looking at and not just blow off of like, oh, it's an adult, they'll just deal with it. We have to do it and move on, right? I feel like that's where it goes in. So I think from our pediatric standpoint, it's a little bit easier because we already naturally do it. I think that the key thing, particularly as myself, an adult trauma surgeon who sometimes has to run that first part of a pediatric resuscitation, is the management of the trauma of the parent or the guardian or whoever shows up with them, or how do you make that call? It's extremely stressful on the parent having to be there and having that loss of control and a lot of concern over the welfare of their child. So I think that managing that as well and understanding that the family are patients too, right? And making sure that everybody's cared for in a compassionate way. I think the tools are basically the same. You know, keep calm, make sure that you're using, you know, understandable words, explain what you're doing and why you're doing it. Ask what their fears are, what they're concerned about, things like that. That all applies, whether it's a child, a parent, or an adult. It's just about making sure that we get the reps in so that we're really doing it with every patient that comes through.
It's interesting. There's so much that I'm learning by talking to the different pilot sites too. And there are three pilot sites that are pediatric level one trauma centers. So we're going to learn a lot about their experience. But also, for example, there is a site in Toronto, and they wanted to include a little bit more focused PowerPoint slides on the Indigenous population there. There is a site in West Virginia, and they wanted to include a bit more about their rural population, Appalachian population. So there has to be fidelity in the concepts, but there can also be a tailored approach that speaks to your community and special needs of your community. In ATLS, we're addressing that along with other special populations, the LGBTQ population community. So that you have this awareness of what fits for your particular community so you can tailor it, whether it's a pediatric trauma center or a rural population and all the other special populations that we need to have an awareness and be deliberate about treating in an appropriate way.
Something that I, for example, we've encountered a few times is, you know, there's an autistic patient that comes in and their parent or caregiver is nearby. Something that I found is helpful when taking care of an autistic patient and their caregiver is nearby is having that caregiver nearby so that that patient can hear their voice and kind of calm down. What are other tactics? Like, what are other things that our audience can kind of come away with in terms of very practical ways to implement this tonight on call, for example?
This is absolutely something that I can walk downstairs and practice immediately by either designating myself or designating the nurse who's putting the IV. Just walk the patient through the different steps of what's happening right now. Okay, now that person's going to cut your clothes off and this is why. Now I'm going to put an IV in your right antecubital fossa. Now someone's going to shine a really bright light in your eye and make sure that it's appropriate in terms of language. And so designating that one person and people feel busy and burned out. And so the question that we get a lot is, this is more, we have to do another. It actually isn't, because typically that person who's designated as the communicator is doing other things as well. We're all multitaskers. So that's why I picked, you know, I'm still going to be the person in charge of watching with the 10,000 foot view, but I also can, you know, be communicating it. Hi, I'm Dr. Rochelle. Here's why this is all happening right now. Bear with us. We just got to get through this first part. We need to make sure you don't have anything major. And it's amazing how not only it diffuses the anxiety that I think any of us would feel, but even worse if you've been through so much trauma over the course of your life, but it also diffuses that room, that controlled chaos. As you know, if you are in there as the trauma surgeon, the way you conduct yourself actually resonates and sets a tone. And so particularly if you designate yourself as the person who's communicating, it's amazing what happens to the room. So stay tuned and try it out tonight.
Yeah, that's great. I think we've all had the experience of the absolutely phenomenal ER nurse that just comes in, everybody just super cool, and just talks to the patient and says, it's okay, we're going to go through this, we're going to do this, go, and just kind of is sort of louder than everybody else and be like, just, hey, listen to my voice. I know there's a lot going on. I'm going to be with you through it. We're here to take care of you and make sure you're okay. You know, just, I'll walk, you know, just some sort of pinpoint for them to hold on to. I think that's really, really important to be able to have.
This has been fantastic. Thank you so much for your knowledge, for all of the efforts around this curriculum. I think this is going to be amazing for ATLS. I hope we're allowed to publish that, because that's going to be a part of the recording.
Yeah, it's totally out of the bag because we've started to write that chapter for ATLS. We're just at the structural point of its scaffolding, but yeah, it's been approved and we've been given the green light to talk about it. So yeah,
perfect. I look forward to that. For any additional information on the work of the iSAVE group for strategies for trauma centers to address root causes of violence, please take a look at our links under the supplemental materials section. Thank you so much, Drs. Dicker and Tatebe. I really appreciate your time, and I hope you'll have a great rest of the day.